Welcome to the second episode of our Sustainable Business Podcast. This time I've got highlights from the Embark event and the Climate Leaders Coalition first anniversary. We hear from Alison Hurft after her trip to the Sustainable Brands Conference, and Rob and I talk to Jeff Vickers and Phil Tate of ThinkStep about foresighting. It was a great day yesterday at Embark with a real buzz in the room, everybody talking about low emissions solutions. I talked to a few of the people who were there, including Gareth Marriott, CEO of OCS.
Embark's been great. You're talking to people, you're listening, but just little ideas, those little nuggets are coming out, and there's already a couple today that I think we've got to just consider, especially about the impact that we have on our customers.
Paul Vine is the head of OI New Zealand.
I think it's great. I mean, I've really enjoyed the sessions this morning too, because what you'll learn is that everyone's on a journey. Everyone's doing something that they've got every right to be really proud of and making progress. But of course, it's an almighty challenge that we've got, and there's a lot more that we need to do. And so I think it's really good to hear about the wins, some of the easy wins that people have, to some of the ones that are a lot more sophisticated. I think that really gets you thinking, and I think the opportunity to be able to talk to other people here, whether they be CEOs or not, is not the point. Is great. I'm finding it very educational too, and actually very inspiring. Actually makes me want to go back up the ante and look for more opportunity as well in our own organisation. Again today, a lot of organisations are unsure about how to tell their story. There's risk in telling the story. But you don't need to be perfect to tell the story either. I mean, there's opportunity.
Barbara Niebel is the Managing Director of ThinkStep Australasia.
The great thing about Embark is it is about connecting people. And it's not only connecting people here, but also beyond, to form relationships, to know who you talk to share your learnings with, who you can ask for experience, because it needs to be done together. So suppliers need to do their bit, a company on their own can't do it without their suppliers doing it, but also not without influencing their clients on how they use their services or products.
Martin Kirk is head of sales at Energy Solution Providers.
Yeah, it's an excellent opportunity to interact with companies and individuals that have a similar interest in terms of a similar drive to help the environment at the end of the day. It's what we do, and it's what we strive to do even better moving forwards, and it's getting more and more people on board that understand the values that we're portraying in market, and for people to realise the benefits in terms of what we can actually provide.
And that's a wrap.
That's a wrap.
Back in June, I caught up with Alison Hurft, our Member and Consumer Decision Making Manager, about her trip to the Sustainable Brands Conference in Detroit.
This is the flagship conference for the Sustainable Brands Network, and once a year they get together with the biggest heavy hitters in the world in what does sustainable brands mean, what are they doing. This year's theme was delivering the good life, which followed up the previous years of redefining the good life and designing it. So this was all about the doing of it, not just talking about it.
So what were some of the highlights?
It was a phenomenal trip. If there was anywhere to be in the world that you're meeting the leaders in who's doing things as well as who's starting, it was very accessible for anyone who wants to find out what the latest issues and trends are. And just to meet people who are really doing something, not just talking about it, with some of the real heavy hitters in the world doing stuff, and not just companies, but other kinds of organisations who are part of it as well. Phenomenal. I think the only downside was there was so much going on that I couldn't get to everything.
And what were some of the key takeaways?
The key things that came out of it, one was a really big push to significantly transform the idea of marketing itself, what that role does and who can do it and where it fits with an organisation. So to really get past the traditional thinking of, you know, product price purchasing and move beyond that, one, to add a new P, which is the P of purpose. So there's lots of talk about purpose-led brands, what that means, how you can do it in a real way and design your company around that. But there was also a big pushback against thinking of people in society as just consumers and market segments. So really a big pushback is in like, this is about people. If we want to have brands for the social and environmental good, we've got to keep people in the mix within our, we've got to work with them in within our organizations, co-design with people and not market them to them as if they're this faceless segment.
Any really memorable speakers?
My favorite was the chief marketing officer from Danone, Valerie Hernando-Press, who talked about how they're designing all of their work around this and about how they work with people and co-design with people and welcomed us all to the human-to-human era. So getting past B2B, B2C thinking, it's just like, it's H2H, human-to-human. And that's how we're going to be able to stay relevant as a brand, and that's how we'll be able to grow because we're doing it with people. There was the debate about purpose-led brands, what that means, a few people getting a bit of purpose fatigue. And so the question was, does every brand need to have this burning purpose that it follows? And the general answer was no, but if you are wanting to have purpose sort of as a key thing that you talk about and design around, here are some ways to do it. But you can go ahead and be a brand that's got social and environmental good in mind without having to have purpose-led sort of everywhere in your comms and everything. Another really interesting thing that came through was the different ways that people are positioning sustainability and their messaging around sustainability. So instead of it being, you know, this big push to make sustainability desirable, attractive, and part of everyday life, particularly as you can't just buy a sustainable life, you need to live it with what we eat, how we move around, where we live and work. So all fantastic ideas and examples of how people are doing this. We had Allbirds showing how their shop fronts, how they call it 3D, three-dimensional design in their messaging for how they engage people in sustainable materials and ways of living. We had Target, who's, you know, about a huge mass market, doing amazing things in everyday society. They talked about their position things as style. So style comes first and sustainability is within that, but it's not sort of thrown as the primary thing in their messaging. We had some interesting stats. For instance, Westrock, who's a packaging company, talked about how when people are looking at what the messages they'll get about a brand sustainability is first through its packaging, what they see that's surrounding that product. And that's far more important than what's on the website and in their report. And with that, there was a lot of talk about product as a service. So this is something that us in New Zealand have heard a lot. We see it coming through all the time, but some really good examples of how businesses are thinking of themselves as our product is a service and we need to design around that. There was quite a key theme around circular economy at this, at Sustainable Brands. We were fortunate to have enough to have Bill McDonough, who is the one of the originators of cradle-to-cradle thinking. And while I personally was wondering if that would, how that fits in 2019, how he was showing that the design thinking that goes around that and how it can be applied to systems thinking and how it's sort of playing out in the field, whether it's got that official title of cradle-to-cradle or not, how that kind of thinking has expanded around the world was fascinating. And there were quite a lot of companies talking about how they are looking at circular economy in their value chain. So CHEP North America, who I was lucky enough to video, they launched their Zero Waste World initiative. There were lots of other brands just talking about how they wanted to add a new element to all their materials, and if the product of a service is, are our items recoverable as well as recyclable? And how are we working with people in the supply chain? And a different view on how they, the metrics they use and how they measure the resources they're using and how that's coming back as feedstock in other places. There was quite a stern warning throughout it, which was valid, which was there's a lot of talk about plastics and about recycling, but it's very dangerous to think that it's mission accomplished if we start recycling things and have a better recycling system. That's a very small part of what's happening. So don't get caught in that trap of, you know, one particular kind of material and one kind of process as being, you've transformed the system. You haven't, you've just addressed one part of it. Useful for marketers about how to get past the value action gap or the intent action gap, which is just what people, when they say they're going to do something or would like to do something, how they, that often translates into them, it's unlikely that they'll go through it. So you might have 65% of people say they want to do something, 30% actually do it. And that's a huge problem for marketers and for brands generally, about for all this great messaging and all this great work, how to actually translate into action. How do you get past that with the different kinds of messages you have, where they turn up? Again, if you're this problem of if you don't focus on people, if you just think about market segments, that's a huge part of the problem. So some really good tips for people about how to close that gap and get action to happen. In the environmental side of things, so there was my personal favourite thing was the suggestion of a science-based targets for forests. How can we think about having a forest positive future? And what does a 1.5 degree equivalent look like in terms of quality and quantity for having the forest amount back in the world that can help biodiversity and ecosystems and be part of the regenerative economy that we talk about? And that's one way to sort of look at how we can create targets to get there and avoid that tipping point where we just don't have enough trees to support the world's systems. There was also the idea of tree equity, just in terms of the kinds of health benefits from, especially in the urban space, having biodiverse trees and plants, what that actually does for the health of communities and people. There was actually a lot of the framing around sustainability was around health, planetary health and people's health as well. So there was definitely a trend towards things like nutrition and well-being in that health way, which is a little bit we've seen in New Zealand, but I expect we'll start to see that more. That there was a fair bit of talk about the sort of social sustainability as well. We had an 11-year-old from Flint, Michigan, talk to us. She was 8 when the water poisoning scandal hit Flint. Pretty much everyone was in tears. It makes me upset even to think about it. And talking about what she and other kids who weren't even, you know, in double digits age by that stage, their activism to get their voices heard and to help people in the community who are suffering and what's happening now, because it's not over. We also heard from True Colours Brewery, a North Carolina brewery that's bringing together men and boys from rival gangs together to work on a social impact enterprise that brews beer. And they do a lot of work with these people to help them grow as people, and then they grow as a team, and it's linked to a campaign to end gun violence. And we had an incredible talk by Ovi Mogeli, who is an ex-fullback from the Ravens. Don't ask me more about football, that's as much as I know. But he was talking about how sports can be a catalyst. And I think that's a call out. I'd love to talk to New Zealand Rugby and other sports codes about that. Getting kids engaged in environmental activism through sports. And he has published a comic called Gridiron Green that it's a little bit like Captain Planet for young Gridiron fans. That was one of the few places that the Sustainable Development Goals was mentioned that I saw because it's linked in this comic book. But oddly enough, the SDGs didn't come up a lot in the rest of the conference, not the sessions I went to anyway. There may have been in other words. And even when questions were asked about it, there weren't really solid answers to companies who are aligning with the SDGs and designing strategy around it, how that fits with this. So yeah, so it feels like there's a bit of a gap in how to connect that to brand thinking and market transformation. But they launched the Brands for Good campaign. And that's a set of three commitments that brands such as, you know, Pepsi, National Geographic, Target, Procter & Gamble and others, the founders have joined this sort of coalition or campaign, and they are committing to these three things within their, in terms of how they align their brand and what they want to, how they want to use it for social and environmental good. I am going to look into that more to see if there's scope for New Zealand brands to join that, and how that's going to roll out globally. And as part of that, there was an action roadmap toolkit that people could do, and we did a test one as well. So there's five different ways that you can look at your operations, products, value chain, messaging, governance, and a few other things. And it gives you a scale of 0 to 5 on all these different areas. And the aim is to get to 5 across all of them that would mark you as a sustainable brand. So that's just in its testing phase at the moment. There's a couple of our members that might trial that, and I'll keep in touch with them to see how that goes, as well as with keep in touch with sustainable brands to see if there's something in it for our members that's not adding to the work we're doing. Is it complementing something we do? Is it a good sort of another internal reflective checkpoint on how we're doing before we get to the polishing the apple stage, which is what they said, you know, you need to do all this internal work to be a real sustainable brand before you can even get to the stage of talking about it. Lots of ideas about other ways to have cultural shift, because again, being about people, all these ideas need to actually be activated by people and owned by people. When we're empowered and there's all these different groups of people being empowered around the world, that's where things can happen. It can't just be in the hands of the brands themselves. They've got the big job to do to make things easier, more accessible and desirable for people. But that includes listening to the voices and including everyone else who gets impacted by this and has a stake in it. If members do contact me about it, this will come up in some of the ongoing Good Life playbook conversations we have, as well as some of the webinars that we'll have. And I'll try and keep you all up to date with how things roll out and the trends as they progress. One, the sense of that this was happening in reality. There is enough pressure on brands being held to account by people that they can't just talk about it anymore. So that's a positive thing with people have to actually do this, or they'll lose relevance or get a bad reputation. And the fact that you had these very big brands that have billions of market share are the ones who are saying they force themselves to be transparent, and they're the ones who are really pushing hard on themselves. Of course, that's not everybody. These are the leaders. But to have these, that it's not niche, these are very big brands doing the work, I think that's quite, makes it a really good aspiration for others. And I think the idea that these, from whichever roles people are coming from, the fact that this is about people and that message is really starting to be heard, that we are getting past the sort of the glossy view on this, that there's this understanding that it's about cultural shift and people are part of culture and people are the architects of culture, that it's on us to do it. And the brands need to just work with that and capture it in a way. Don't forget that you have personal power as well, that we all create our culture, and so we can take a part in re-engineering culture or recreating things and shifting it. There's this mixture of art and science. Sustainability is not just about numbers and stats, and it's not just about pretty, beautiful things to capture our attention. There's a real blend of all of that, and it's very inspiring to be around some very clever people that are blending art and science in a way to engage us and get these positive changes to happen.
That was a great overview of the conference, but if you've got any questions and you want to know more, please do get in touch with Ali.
Today I'm talking to Phil Tate and Jeff Vickers of ThinkStep and Robert Perry of SBC, and we're talking about foresighting. Tell us a bit about yourselves, first of all. Phil Tate.
I, with Jeff, work with ThinkStep, and I've been involved in the foresight world, I guess, now for the last 8 years or so, working as a consultant to help organisations think constructively about the future. And so I am trained in Foresight and a member of the Association of Professional Futurists. I came to Foresight, I think, because I'd previously been in strategic roles, and a lot of the time in those kind of processes, the strategy is put together namely for one function, which is to unlock a budget. Often we go through a bit of a process which starts sometime before the beginning of the financial year, when people cobble together something of a SWOT analysis, which looks vaguely coherent, and then is used to unlock a reasonably operational budget for the following year, but then fundamentally is not too closely scrutinized. And I relate to Foresight fundamentally to an iterative process about thinking about the future. So that's what we look to do, to help people, you know, constructively engage with future ideas ahead of time.
Hi everyone, I'm Jeff Vickers from ThinkStep. I came to Foresight around the same time I came to sustainability back in 2006. And I'm probably more an on-again, off-again Foresight person, unlike Phil. I saw the value in Foresight right from the beginning for sustainability because, you know, in many respects, sustainability is inherently about the future. And it's inherently about, you know, the distribution of things between the present generations and future generations. And so Foresight is sort of fundamental to sustainability in many ways. And yet it is relatively rarely applied. It gets applied in certain areas, but for something that is so critical, it's quite interesting that it doesn't get applied in virtually all sustainability contexts. And I think, you know, part of what we're hoping to do is to correct that sort of miscarriage of justice, if you like, regarding the use of Foresight and sustainability, because it is fairly fundamental from our perspective.
And Rob.
Kia ora, Robert Parry. I lead the sustainability leadership portfolio for SBC. And I guess my interest in Foresighting started when I was working on Low Carbon Auckland. We applied it in a manner that allowed us to think about what could be, what a potential future could be, rather than what was going to be likely. And reflecting on conversation with SBC members, whether that be sustainability managers or directors, one of the key things we're hearing is, how do we get ahead of the curve on emerging issues? Because the pace of change is relentless. No one can really predict the future, but Foresight really helps to map the futures that could be, so we can be better prepared no matter what the future emerges.
So why should New Zealand businesses be thinking about foresighting?
I think in many respects, New Zealand businesses already are, but they don't know it necessarily. Foresight per se is not necessarily trying to get a better forecast. It's about reflecting on the assumptions that we hold about the future inherently now, and what that is doing to our current business decisions. Part of the process of brand foresighting is actually to say, what are the assumptions that we collectively hold? Which of those assumptions may in some respects be open to challenge? And if they are fundamentally misplaced, those assumptions, what are some of the futures that could emerge? And what should we be looking to do about that? And what should we look to influence in that future?
And I think from my perspective, you know, if you're looking at sustainability in terms of two overarching strategies, mitigation and adaptation, foresight can help with both. So it can help you to mitigate, but it can also importantly help you to adapt and to be more resilient. And as we get further and further towards 2030 and start to miss more and more of our targets that we supposedly should be hitting because they're becoming increasingly impossible, that adaptation resilience part of sustainability is going to become so much more important.
So the next question is, how can foresighting help businesses with sustainability? I think you've addressed that quite well, but is there anything else that you specifically want to talk about on sustainability?
We're seeing sustainability issues such as climate change, water quality, youth unemployment, and plastics in a really dominating public discussion and a priority issues for businesses to address. And as I said earlier, the speed in which these issues are emerging is accelerating, and Kiwi companies need to get better at anticipating and being prepared for these issues, which a good sustainability process allows them to do. But thinking 5, 10, 30 years ahead, you know, let alone a seven generations thinking, which underpins the likes of Naitahu's business model, is really challenging. And you know, is still sometimes at odds with our focus on quarterly returns. It's really a great tool to help embed those issues into business strategy, business thinking.
The other thing I'd like to add as well is that often we look at the future in a certain, you know, a series of linear functions. And the aspect of foresight is around trying to bring together a number of different dimensions which themselves may coalesce to create those different futures, and thinking in terms of more than one dimension, not just linear thinking as such. And I guess one of the a classic I often come across, which may be a little ironic in the context of this conversation, is the US coal industry, which in 2011, the top four of the companies had a combined capitalization of something like $33 billion. 2017, they had a capitalization for those four of $150 million, and three of them had gone through Chapter 11. This was after their CEO back in 2011 had said, we're going to have the best decade ever. So clearly there were a lot of factors that came together, even in a business which obviously has a number of different dimensions to the sustainability question. But even in a business where you think, well, this is relatively straightforward to say what's going to occur, and the way that they thought about that future affected the way that they acted in the present. And the reasons for their demise were multifaceted. So that's why it's really important for businesses not just to focus on one specific issue and get caught out, but when another point process, like, for example, plastics, suddenly jumps out from left field and catches everyone by surprise.
I think just building on both of those sorts of points, futures and foresight are really about managing uncertainty in an increasingly complex world. And, you know, by considering multiple possible futures, by considering your underlying assumptions and how things may play out, it gives you a way of better managing those events should they come up, and better responding and making better decisions today. And so I think it's really about, it is about managing uncertainty. It is about managing risk. It's about, it's not just about sustainability, right? It's about foresight. It's about, you know, having a successful business as well. And a lot of it's been developed for that purpose and then later been applied to sustainability. So I think the two things fit nicely together, but ultimately it's about the success of the businesses as well as the success of society. You know, over the very long term, if you're doing things that are good for society, then you're likely to be a successful business. And so, you know, that long-term foresight, looking at societal change, it's not only good for society, but it's potentially good for business too, because it identifies the opportunities where you can do things that contribute something of value to people both now and in the future. And so it's really, you know, the longer you look, the more business goals are aligned with societal goals.
And Jeff raises the S word there, and I think the society word is quite important, because one of the things that motivates me in terms of trying to help people think of those constructive futures is that we obviously live in some relatively challenging times. And what we're trying to do through a foresight process is, yes, we will always be surprised about the future, but could we at least try and get beyond some of the big surprises, which if they, I mean, for example, if Thwaites falls off tomorrow and we're all looking at a significant sea level rise, well, where did that come from? You know, so we need to be having these conversations across society so that people are attuned to some of the possibility and they've started to absorb and shift their own thinking. We can see elsewhere in the world where clearly there are some stresses in society which to a certain extent have been driven by the fact that some people's futures have not been addressed at all. And so I think that's really important, that it's almost a community muscle that we are not really great at, which is how do we have some of these conversations, tricky as they are sometimes, to move our thinking forward, which in a sense is then becomes transformational as opposed to just incremental shift.
I think those difficult conversations are going to become increasingly frequent, unfortunately. You know, as things move on and progress, does this particular town, which happens to be in a floodplain that's then affected by, you know, increasing storms and, you know, increasing flood risk, should we remain here? Do we need to move? But I think what, you know, foresight and futures enables you to do is to have those conversations early, to be having them now, and then perhaps, you know, together as a community or a group of people to move forward around perhaps a shared outcome or a desirable future for that group or community, rather than, oh, it's now 20 years from now, everything's not worked out well. we have to do something and we have to do it now, and then forcing decisions upon people because you have no choice. You know, we can start to have those conversations far earlier and start to build up consensus, which I think is increasingly important. Mm-hmm. And perhaps a lesson that we could learn from other societies and other cultures, like, for example, Scandinavian cultures, for example, where they're much better at consensus building.
Absolutely. And shall we look at the New Zealand landscape for a moment? Are there any New Zealand businesses who are doing foresight at the moment?
For example, at the moment, working with a cross-government team to look at ways in which certain factors are emerging and what are certain trends and drivers that are emerging that need to be looked at a cross-agency level, because that's obviously quite a big push at the moment. And I'm thinking of one particular business in the broadcast space now. They looked at a number of scenarios of the future, and what you typically find is that, as they did, there's no one scenario go, oh yeah, that's brilliant. Everything in that scenario is amazing. That's the one we want, and of course we'll have it. The reality is that most scenarios have bits you kind of, not so sure about that. Or that's okay. But the question then becomes, how do we try and create the conditions which create the good bits and ameliorate the conditions which potentially avoid the bad bits? And how do we address some of the questions that seem to emerge, like this one was particularly around editorial independence in a changing funding model? And the beauty of that is that you can have a conversation in relatively easy terms, because it's not actually fundamentally threatening somebody's role or job on the coming next Monday morning. It's a conversation which is beyond the immediate operational sphere that allows people to unpick some of the ideas that they're running with and come to, hopefully, as Jeff mentioned, a more of a consensus view as to how they might move forward.
I think one of the key examples that I can reflect on is the work of Port of Auckland. I mean, from our perspective, you can't go much further than from the ports. You know, they're really leading the way from what I'm seeing in terms of foresighting. You know, you think of what they're doing right now, you know, they're planning for the long-term future of the port. And that's a future that's embracing innovation. It's embracing zero carbon future. And not just thinking about the effects of automation, which is still front of mind for them. And I think, you know, one of the reflections that I had from SBC's leadership program was that change can be really unsettling. And the ports have really recognized that and grasped it. And they're using foresight not only to plan that future, but also to engage their own staff and other key stakeholders to explore what the port of the future could look like, and to develop a comprehensive change program, really, to prepare for that future and to ensure that its people thrive in the transitions that go with that change.
From my perspective, virtually all organizations that have long-term assets have to think about the future, you know, and they do. So seaports, airports, infrastructure and utilities companies like Watercare, you know, all of those types of organizations are better at thinking about the future than their more short-term peers. So there are lots of businesses with very long-term planning horizons in New Zealand. You know, even organizations like Fisher & Paykel Healthcare, for example, they plan 20, 30 years out. So there's a lot of that sort of long-term thinking. I guess it's just connecting that long-term thinking with some of the tools from the foresight area, which could perhaps benefit those organizations, and making it a bit more formal, perhaps.
There's also a question as well that how do we protect the long-term thinking? That foresight fundamentally is not just about coming up with a future that you prefer to have and then leaving it at that. I mean, I'm sure the likes of Ports of Auckland, they've not just got the strategy in there, they've popped it in the drawer and they've got the plan going on. They'll also be thinking as well, okay, we thought this would be changing. How is it changing? You know, what are the leading indicators of change which we need to keep an eye on, which may suggest that we're not heading on this particular future, but we're going to that particular future. In that context, we thought we would do this. So it's also, as I mentioned before, again, it's an incremental process which says, what are some of the things which are really important to this business, which if they change could actually change some of our thinking. A good example of that, actually, I was listening to Bill Reid present, who's on the regenerative side, to a built environment audience the other day, Vic Uni, and he talked about the nature of social license. We think about, say, developing a patch of land. I own the land, I've got my developer, I've got my architect, I've got everything lined up, let's go. Well, it's not the same these days, in the sense that that social license dimension has become quite a big issue. And if you lose it, it's a problem, as we see, for example, down here in Shelley Bay in Wellington. And so even those things which typically maybe not necessarily align to your business, you might have in the past thought, social license, well, it's my way or the highway in that context, that doesn't hold true. So it's a question also of what are the things that will change around us in society that could actually shift the business forward in the future.
And I think that point you made about this sort of separation of strategy and foresight is particularly important, because there's a lot of businesses that also separate sustainability and strategy as well, which in my mind doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, how is the long-term viability of your business not a core part of strategy? So for me, foresight, sustainability, strategy are all essentially linked around, how the business operates and moves forwards.
One particular organization which couldn't seem to understand why sustainability was not a strategic function. And when you're arguing about whether you should reduce your fuel target next year by 2% or 1.5%, we're not really in the ballpark of thinking strategically now. We're thinking very much tactically and operationally, and sustainability is not a tactical or operational function. It has to be at the heart and center of any strategy for any business.
I think it's quite clear that the future of sustainability lies in regeneration, regenerative thinking. If you think about a future in 1.5 degrees, that sustainability as we know it today is not going to deliver us what's needed or the future that we want. Good business will be about replenishing and restoring what's been lost and having a positive effect, not just in terms of the environment, but also prosperity of its people and driving profit in the process. So yeah, I think sustainability as we know it today is going to evolve even further and a lot more rapidly.
You use the R word as well there, Rob, in terms of the regenerative space too. And I think that's quite critical in foresight terms as well, because it's all about the systems. What is the broader systems of which I'm operating, which historically we've not been great at? Regenerative thinking is all about looking at what is the potential to assist that broader system, however you define it. And yes, we do have some way to go. I was at a launch or an event at the Governor General's house a couple of weeks back, where a number of Pacifica youth had just gone through 2 or 3 days with, they'd been using foresight tools and such like to consider the impact of climate within the Pacific. And they were presenting that back to us in the evening. And it was quite, to be honest, it was quite a confronting a presentation, in the sense that, is your profit worth more than my island? Was, I would guess, if I'm paraphrasing what they were saying. The following day, I was at the launch of an infrastructure report here in Wellington too. And a comment that was made from the stage on that one was that land without infrastructure has no value, which struck me as a contrast in terms of the previous night, in terms of the broader system. And then if you look at land effectively as just a tool for extraction, that is a kind of mindset, I think, which will still, we've got some way to go, because we have to think more holistically about the systems in which we operate and how is it that our individual businesses add to the value of that system, as opposed to mining them effectively as a resource for our own potential profit. And that is the big shift that has still yet to occur in certain sectors, I believe.
And I think also, it's not just all about ownership. It's actually about our relationship with land and environment.
Yes, and I think we often use the word transformational, and it's misused. Yeah, so we think of transformation as some form of, maybe we've shifted the structure chart around or whatever it might be. Transformational fundamentally should be around how we change our thinking. And to your point there, Rob, I mean, we are very much wedded to, we own this, it's mine, that's sort of a personal ownership perspective. And we've got there from, obviously many centuries of thinking. But we need to actually examine some of those assumptions too, as to what do potentially new models and ways of being come about, which we can explore. And again, as I say, in a less confrontational way, if you're talking about a number of scenarios and you can build up some thinking that says, well, actually, that's not, we could move to that, whatever it might be, which is not as perhaps as threatening as suddenly saying to somebody, you know what, you don't own that land after all. which clearly would lead to more tension and such like.
Which is one of the fundamental principles of underpinning Te Māori.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, we have a lot to learn.
We do.
How can New Zealand businesses get started on foresighting? What advice would you give them?
Well, I think I came across the Three Horizons structure as a thinking tool some years back. It's actually emanates from the UK by a chap called Bill Sharp. He put this tool together with some colleagues, and there's quite a lot of information about it, but it's a way of really thinking about different mindsets and how we approach the future. It's like many of these tools in foresight terms. It can be used at different ways through the foresight process, depending on how mature your own internal thinking is. I used it some years ago to help the tourism industry start to think about their sustainability process. They understood that they needed to shift, and they certainly have shifted in the last 2-3 years. And it enabled them to come together to have a conversation, which allowed them to move beyond possibly some of the structured ways of thinking that they'd done to that point. So that's really a good place to start. By all means, it's not obviously the place to finish either. There's other tools that can and should be used to help people to consider what it is that's important for the business going forward. But it certainly looks at those different perspectives of, you know, managerial, entrepreneurial, and visionary, which often occur within businesses, across businesses, but not necessarily in the same individual. But it respects all those perspectives as well, and shifts us away from sort of just in mindset terms.
And so ThinkStep will be holding a workshop on the 30th of July here in Wellington. What can people expect?
Indeed. So we're having an event down in Wellington, which follows the Auckland one, and which introduces, I guess, some of the ideas around foresight. Talks a little bit about that experience within the tourism industry as a bit of a case study. And then I explain how the Three Horizons tool works and has come about, and a little bit of background to that as well, which people can get more information with. But then we have actually a little bit of a run through of the tool so people can get some hands-on experience. The idea being that not necessarily that we get blinding insights from that, but people can get some sense of how it works, and that they then could potentially use the tool themselves and use that as a way to generate conversations within their own respective organizations without having to, you know, invest heavily in, I don't know, for example, a scanning environment, so, or, you know, a big foresight project. And I mean, typically that's not the way it's done in New Zealand anyway. People have obviously got more constrained resources than perhaps internationally, and they're looking for particular tools which are relevant and which they can pick up and run with pretty much immediately with relatively lower overheads.
And Rob, so you'll be there, we'll also have Diane Edwards from Ports of Auckland.
So my role will be just to set the scene, really, provide the context in terms of how sustainability has grown as a discipline and the connection between embedding sustainability into your organization and the role of different the need for a different type of leadership and new tools to embed long-term thinking into your business models. Diane will give a real practical business perspective on what this actually means in reality, how to get started, what are the fundamental steps to take, because it is a journey. And hopefully that she'll share some of the challenges and the benefits. So real just bringing it to life, really.
My colleague Barbara Niebel will also be talking about our transport futures work, where we looked at a range of scenarios for the New Zealand transport sector, looking at sort of radical decarbonisation strategies, looking at biofuels, electrification, hydrogen, and what the implications of those would be for the New Zealand sort of as a nation. And we'll sort of share how we used futures and scenario building to make that assessment.
Okay, well, that's a really good overview of foresighting and how it can be applied in New Zealand. So thank you all very much for your time, and look forward to catching up with you and the team on the 30th of July in Wellington.
Awesome. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you, Catherine.
Great.